Happy election night, everyone. And I just had a long pause because I don't have anything to add on elections whatsoever on this show, because my opinions on politics is not why you listen. We do have some solid games to get to, a chance to lock in, only a 4-game night. I kind of like these Tuesdays early in the season, even if it's not the greatest games in the world, because there are a few games, there are 4 of them, so we're able to watch most of all those games. And it's some teams that aren't necessarily that sexy, but those are the teams I think early in the season it's important to catch up on, so that we could then avoid having to watch them when they're tanking later in the year. But two teams that I do not anticipate will be tanking at any point in time this season, Milwaukee and Portland. This is an excellent game. Just overall, in terms of the quality of play, Portland pulled away late to take it 118-103, behind 40 from CJ McCollum. Dame Lillard actually only had 13 in this game, but McCollum was on fire, torching the Bucks in mid-range. Giannis paced the Bucks with 23, although he didn't do a ton. 9 of his 11 field goals were dunks, though. And Brook Lopez dropped 6 three-pointers on his way to 22 points, although only 3 Bucks reached double figures. So, Danny, where did you want to start on this game? What are your takeaways?
I like the point that Frank Madden made on Twitter after the game, which is to separate this from Milwaukee's loss to the Celtics, where a game we did for the NBA cast, where the Bucks were just conceding all of these pick and pop threes and then a bunch of other open shots. And while they do have weaknesses on those shots and also on pull up threes, there were a few of those moments in this game as well. Generally speaking, the trade-off that is central to the Bucks' defensive identity is giving up mid-range shots and not giving up shots at the rim, ideally not fouling too. We'll see how much that continues. And generally speaking, that's a good trade-off. You know, that's the kind of thing that you're looking for, because mid-range shots are less valuable than shots at the rim. However, there will be nights, most notably in many ways against teams like the Warriors and the Blazers, where giving up a bunch of mid-range shots just due to variance, due to everything else, can hurt you. And Portland has some of the best mid-range shooters in the entire
NBA. In particular, McCollum, who was 8 out of 10 for mid-range. I want to draw a little bit of a line between the Bucks defense in the third quarter and in the fourth quarter, because I felt like in the third, these were very, very easy shots. And I think perhaps Stotts came out of halftime saying, hey, Brook Lopez, especially if you're going to leave him on the floor, because Lopez was on fire from three-point range, he's going to just lay back in the pick and roll. Again, I mean, the Bucks were giving up nothing at the rim through most of this game. So he said, hey, we're just going to go to CJ in pick and roll, and we're going to have Yusuf Nurkic, who sets some of the better screens in the game, and then we're just going to get him wide open 17-footers. And they got a few of those to start with. And while the mid-range shot might not be the greatest shot in the world for a lot of people, wide open CJ McCollum, like, he's going to start to make that hurt you. And they also were actually able to get to the rim as well in that third quarter for 6 out of 9 shooting there. So it wasn't like they were just only getting mid-rangers, as we've seen in some other Bucks games. It was that they're also giving up some plays to Nurkic at the rim. So it seemed a little bit too easy for Portland and CJ in that third quarter when he dropped 19 of his 40. In the fourth quarter was a little bit of a different story. Those mid-rangers were largely contested, and the Blazers did put up 27 points in a pretty slow quarter, but they went 5 out of 12 from 3 and 4 of 4 from mid-range, and only took one shot at the rim and got to the line twice. This game in particular was just an incredibly low free throw game. Only 16 free throws attempted in the entire game. And the Blazers, for all the dunks that they gave up to Giannis, they did a good job of not fouling. They only let him get to the line for 2 attempts, and I thought that was important for them.
On that note, as of right now, Milwaukee and Portland are 2 of the 4 top teams in opponent free throw attempt rate. That is not a surprise after watching this game.
And hanging the big back and pick and roll can also be a good way to avoid giving up fouls. Now, both teams, usually the Blazers in particular, are set up to take away the three-point line. They were not able to do that against the Bucks, with the Bucks getting up 42 three-point attempts, but the Blazers did them one better with 43 and 17 makes rather than 16 for the Bucks. It was really a pretty remarkably close statistical game in nearly every metric. And yeah, this is crazy. Offensive rebounds, turnovers were all within 1, but the Bucks shot 48% on twos and the Blazers shot 65% on twos. A lot of it with those mid-range jumpers. Even Evan Turner was getting into the act as well. What else did you have in this one?
Milwaukee's shot chart in this game is really fascinating. I mean, other than not getting to the free throw line, there are some serious serious, if you want to call it Maury Ball elements of this. Not only, you know, they said they got up 42 three-pointers in this game, they got another 35 of their shots in the restricted area. So 42, 35, and then 15 everywhere else. And the challenge there is that you have to actually have those shots go in. So they shot 60%, which is a little bit lower than you'd expect in the restricted area. They also weren't getting to the foul line. Didn't make many of their shots from floater range, 2 of 9. Didn't make their mid-rangers like Portland was. And then, you know, they shot fine from three. I'm not going to ever, you know, knock a team for going 16 of 42. But they posted an offensive rating about 110, and that wasn't enough to win this game with the shots that Portland was taking and making.
Yeah, I mean, for Portland to put up a 125 offensive rating on the shot mix that they had was really, really impressive. And, you know, that's just the type of shot making that CJ McCollum can do. And then Evan Turner, he's been a lot better this year, I think. Having him as kind of the captain of the ship on that all second unit lineup late in the first, beginning of the second, and then again in the second half, same time, has been a better role for him because he can create shots. He's not going to be incredibly efficient overall. You don't want him taking shots at the hands of CJ and Dame, but he can do enough to kind of run the offense, maybe set up their shooters a little bit and get to a mid-ranger if there isn't much else available. And today he had 16 points and 11 rebounds, 4 assists, and actually played his 32 minutes. So he did get some time with the other stars. And, you know, he wasn't getting amazing shots, but sometimes those are going to go in. I mean, you want to chalk a little bit of this up to make or miss league. The math just didn't work out for the Bucks this time. I agree it wasn't as egregiously bad as the Boston game, in terms of just how it looked and the way that the scheme was so obviously being exploited. But you still wonder. Now, it's really weird because the three Bucks games that I've watched really locked in on in their entirety has been the three games probably where their defenses looked worse. Kemba lit them up on opening night. Big surprise, pick and roll point guard. Celtics lit them up, although it wasn't really Kyrie in pick and roll that much. It was more the Horford pick and pop, and then the way that the Celtics were able to just drive in and then throw it to the weak side for threes. So maybe I've caught them in the three worst defensive games. Their numbers overall still look awesome. They're going to have another really hard test against the Warriors. We'll see them in person on Thursday night. And I am a little bit disappointed so far in Giannis this season. We talked about this on the 15 and 60, but just the turnovers are up. He had 6 again tonight. And other than just kind of either getting out in transition or bludgeoning guys one-on-one and going in for a dunk, which obviously is very effective, but you know, he still doesn't seem to have added to his game. He tried to change up his shot, it looks like. Now he's just bringing it up even further in front of him. The jumper looks even more awkward now. So I would have thought that he would be powering this surge with another great season. But frankly, I think he played better at the start of last year than he's playing now.
A point that I was going to make and then lost track of during the 15 and 60 is that I think one of the takeaways for me, and this is early, I'm not wedded to this forever, but I am thinking it will be the case long term, is that this season has been a reminder of why you want another capable ball handler with Giannis. There had been this interesting idea of, oh man, if you can give the ball to Giannis all the time, you could get all these like-sized guys, you could do switching and all these other ideas. And in the half court, I think that you need at least one other guy who can do that. And fortunately, those players are available, but there are usually trade-offs with them. So whether that is Eric Bledsoe or Malcolm Brogdon or some third person that we don't yet know about is an open question. But I'm feeling more confident that that is a priority for the Bucks. And when you consider that all of the players that fit the description I just made are pending free agents for them, it's something they have to think about when they're building this team out for the remaining time that they have Giannis under this current contract.
Yeah, it's funny that they've started this season so well, and really, you don't think of anyone on this team as an elite talent other than Middleton and Giannis at this point. You know, the rest of these guys kind of seem replaceable, frankly. And Bledsoe, I predicted he was. Yeah.
Well, I'll push back on that a little bit. They're replaceable, but they're also capable.
Sure.
And that's a big difference too. I mean, Ersan Ilyasova and Brook Lopez being in their rotation as opposed to some of the absolute dreck that they've been putting out there over the last couple of years is a massive, massive change.
Yeah, that's an important point.
That's an interesting place to talk about Dante DiVincenzo. DiVincenzo, it's so funny how for me everything, and this happens with young players, it's all flashes or fizzles. Like, you know, like when you see the confidence that he has on his jump shot, you go, oh man, like if he can just convert this, maybe it's gonna, you know, hopefully it'll go in more than it has so far. But then you also see the challenges that he has defensively, and he'll get better just like anybody else will. And so I'm unsure what his NBA career will hold. There's a lot that I really like there, But and this isn't just CJ McCollum putting him on skates and anything like
which
that.
Which he did.
It's, you know, losing guys on possession. Which he did. But it's, you know, the possession by possession stuff. And sometimes focusing on, you know, the guy who takes the shot can be misleading because there are other breakdowns in a defense. And DiVincenzo is a part of those, like a lot of young players are. And so I'm not sure how much of an answer he'll be. Certainly intriguing. Happy that he's getting regular rotation minutes. But we'll just have to see with it because he does bring something they need. It's just whether he takes too much off the table when we're talking about really good opponents. Like you just talked about the three games that you've locked in on. Those were three Milwaukee games against full strength opponents that are very, very, that are capable of attacking what they don't do well. So we'll have to see how that works out. But I'm excited to at least have that volatility in the rotation. And, you know, they still have all the stuff to figure out with Bledsoe and Brogdon and everything else. So I think they can be a lot better against elite competition than they've been so far. And I mean, if they just keep beating the ever-loving crap out of bad teams, their place within the Eastern Conference hierarchy will be fine anyway.
Yeah, and they certainly have been doing that. You mentioned DiVincenzo. CJ had a couple of buckets on him just in straight ISO. And I think I'd like to see CJ get a chance against guys his size or smaller. Almost play kind of more of a Sam Cassell type of game. Use his body, create space. He has that high release. And CJ is such a good shooter that if he can get it off, he's got a pretty damn good chance of making it. A lot of times he'll get the switch and try to go to work against a bigger guy, but because he doesn't really, he's not that quick, and we detailed some of his struggles shooting at the rim this year, that'll be something to check on for the next 15 and 60, but he was 4 out of 25 as of the first 15 and 60 that we did. I think that it's almost better off just saying, hey, let's put him up against someone where he can get the jumper off against this guy by shooting over the top of him more easily, and being, as opposed to, oh, he's got the quickness advantage against this guy, but he's got longer arms and can potentially bother CJ's shot a little more. And I think a lot of teams just would be slightly better off letting their smaller guys, point guard size guys, just go to work against whoever's guarding them. If you are going to ISO me, rather than trying to get a switch necessarily in certain matchups, obviously it depends who that point guard is, who that big is. A few other notes on this one. The Blazers actually went to Nurkic and Collins together for a time at the end of the third as they were building their lead. That worked okay. You know, the Bucks don't really go to many small lineups. Then at the start of the fourth, I thought this was the time when the Bucks really could have broke out. They brought Giannis back. They had Giannis and Middleton out there against that all reserve unit with Leonard and Collins as the two bigs. They scored 8 straight points. And then I thought the biggest shot of the game was actually Myers Leonard, who had had an atrocious start to the quarter. He gives up 2 wide open threes to Ilyas over there. Lucky that one of them didn't miss, or that one of them missed, I should say. He just, you know, just weird mistakes that Leonard made, just leaving him wide open. He misses an open three. He gets thrown a flaming bag at the end of the shot clock, goes to the jab step. If you're guarding Myers Leonard at the end of the shot clock, I'm not sure why you're falling for a jab step, but it was just enough that he was able to get his three-pointer off and make it. And then they got a couple more tough Evan Turner free throw line jumpers, mid-rangers, and, you know, just got just enough shot making to hold on until CJ was able to come in and the rest of the starters and maintain the lead. And the Bucks never really threatened that much. I think it got within 5 at one point.
I looked it up, and per Cleaning the Glass, Portland currently has a plus 3.7 net rating with neither Lillard nor McCollum on the floor, which is very good. I mean, if you could be above water with those two guys off, then, I mean, you hope that you'll be able to beat other teams. And something that surprised me is they were actually positive, a much more slight positive last year. They were plus 1.4. Yeah. And remarkably, because of how they're doing the stagger differently this year, they've already played almost as many possessions without those two this year as they did last year.
I was interested to hear you say that. I figured that was the case because they almost never did that last year. But it seems to be working so far.
Oh, and a point on that. I think that works a lot better in the regular season than it will in the playoffs, but they can break that rotation if they need to, you know, if they're facing better opponents and everything else. Like, just because those lineups will be structured, even if those guys are playing more minutes, just the stressors that quality teams put on opponents is very different.
Anything else you got on this one?
Well, I don't think that it was a particularly strong game for either Pat Connaughton or the guy who replaced Pat Connaughton, Jake Layman. You know, Layman is actually sort of replacing Mo Harkless right now, as Mo Harkless is dealing with the injury we talked about. But I think that part of what those teams are, what Portland is dealing with is just not having enough quality forwards. I mean, they have a lot of good things on this roster, and presumably adding somebody else on that line would be taking somebody away. But I mean, you just, Aminu has to shoulder so much of the burden for what, for doing forward things. I've talked about this for the Lakers in terms of centers, that, you know, the, for centers, it's setting screens, protecting the rim. And for forwards, it's, you know, switching a little bit defensively, making sure that you're covering all the seams and battling some of the toughest man-to-man covers. And Aminu is basically their only guy to do all that kind of stuff. Turner can maybe in limited portions do some of it. And that's a challenge. It's, you know, I would argue that it's something they should have been drafting for over the last couple of years. And the other thing I want to mention is that I've really enjoyed how capable most of the time Zach Collins looks. This was not necessarily his best game, but, you know, I think he generally, you know, he moves well on defense. He trusts his jump shot. I mean, he only made one of his 3 3-pointers, but, you know, 1 out of 3 is okay. And he's been solid on it overall so far this year. And that will have impacts on Portland's center rotation moving forward. I mean, they have Nurkic on a reasonable contract. They can move him if they feel that Collins ends up being the answer. So, again, it's one of those things. I don't have a firm answer yet, but I've liked what I've seen.
Yeah, Collins had this really confident drive on Ilyasova where he went to a spin move, drove in from the 3-point line, and went in for a layup. And that drive made me think of something, which is, you know, we've seen so much more of big guys with the ball in their hands. Blake Griffin's, although he's certainly a solid ball handler. AD is doing it now. Cousins a lot. Last year, seeing bigs kind of drive in from the 3-point line. Part of that is just because bigs are more skilled now than they used to be. But another part of it is just that there's so much more space on the floor, right? Like, it used to be when there wasn't space, big guys would try to do that. They would just run into guys and commit charges. They'd get the ball stolen by guards. But now that those guards are just hugging up against three-point shooters, big guys actually have a lot more ability to go to work, even if maybe, you know, they kind of get a little tunnel vision and they put their head down and they're not the greatest passers once they put the ball on the floor. That doesn't matter as much because there's just more space. It's harder for the help to get there, especially when you're more worried about threes. I mean, I think that for some of these guys, teams could go with more of an opportunity double because they're just not looking to pass necessarily once they take that first dribble. But generally, the instructions are hug to the three-point shooters. And if it's someone like Zach Collins, you're like, okay, we're not helping on Zach Collins. You don't want to open someone up so you can stop Zach Collins. So I think that's just an interesting trend to see, especially with guys who are, you know, a little bit more limited, but still will do stuff off the dribble out on the floor more than maybe in past years. All right, we got some other games to get to, but first, this from Quip. She went to my 6-month checkup today with the dentist. And usually that cleaning can be a pretty miserable experience. They got to scrape all the tartar off. Maybe you find a cavity. Sometimes your gums might be a little sensitive. But I went in today and it was like really painless. And my dentist, the last couple of times I've come in, has actually complimented me. And I told him, yeah, well, it's because I'm using Quip now. It's so much easier to use, and it makes sure with their 2-minute timer with pulses every 30 seconds that remind you when to switch sides that you're doing a better job brushing. It doesn't require a big clunky charger either. So now when I go on vacation, like on my honeymoon, I'm able to just throw it in my dop kit. It's got that AAA battery that lasts for 3 months. It's just a better electric toothbrush that makes brushing far less of a hassle. I wish this was their slogan. It's not, but it's a funny concept that my sister articulated, the idea of sweater teeth when you've got plaque all over your teeth and you can actually feel it with your tongue. Well, you're not going to have that if you can avoid sweater teeth if you have Quip. The way to get started with them, and it is easy to do so considering they start at just $25, is at the website getquip.com/capspace. So that's getquip.com/capspace, and the slash capspace, easy to remember because we talk about it all the time on the program. So get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/capspace. I don't know if that's slash capspace URL that you came from us. All right, what delicious matchup should we talk about next year?
I think we should go to the Queen City, and Charlotte, Atlanta was, I think the story of this game, as it so often is for the Hawks, is Trae Young giveth and Trae Young taketh away. I mean, I think it was the third quarter. It might have been the second. He was just tearing up Charlotte.
It was the second quarter.
He was getting good shots.
5 of 5 at the rim.
He's just tearing up Charlotte.
5 of 5 at the rim in the second quarter.
Yeah, and getting all those good looks, doing a lot of positive offensively on the court. And, you know, in that second quarter, they did outscore Charlotte 29-28. But Young isn't good defensively, has a lot of room to go to get decent defensively. And that is is a problem when you are facing one Kemba Walker.
Yeah, I thought that Young, I mean, you know, this is a developmental season for the Hawks, certainly. They won't mind if they get a higher draft pick. Young had the matchup against Kemba Walker most of the time. They could have maybe said, hey, Trey, go guard Nick Batum or guard Lamb. Both those guys have size that could hurt him a little bit. But there are a few plays where he just totally gave up, right? I mean, and plays where the guy kind of made him look bad a little bit, you know, got a crossover or just wrong-footed him slightly. But then he just kind of gave up, like, I don't want to be on the highlight reel or something, instead of, you know, you just have to keep competing. In today's day and age, as a point guard, it's all about, yeah, you might have got screened off, but you're going to keep trying. You're going to compete. You're going to make it difficult for the guy. You're going to fix it. So at the very least, yeah, you might have space right now, but you're going to recover because allow your big man to help and then recover himself. And I thought that Trey really did not do a good job of that. There are just a couple of specific highlights where he just completely deactivated after the initial move, even in a one-on-one situation, which was a little disheartening. Atlanta, they started Trey Young, Kevin Huerter, and Amari Spellman at the four all together. I mean, that is just not a good defensive lineup. But they actually did okay in the first half. They led 54-51 at halftime. And we can talk more about some of their individual performances. But overall, it was just too much Kemba Walker for the Hornets. He continues to sizzle. He is maybe the best guy in the league now at, you know, you could put maybe Dame Lillard up in this category as well, as a guy who can come around a screen, even if the guy is kind of on his back, still rise up, still be on the move, kind of leaning forward and shoot a three if the big is hanging back at all, and make it. You know, I mean, he's hitting these kind of floating three-pointers on the move, which are really, really impressive. And Walker finished with 29 points. He was 12 of 22 from the field, 4 out of 10 from downtown, 7 assists, 3 steals. And in a game like this against a team like the Hawks, Kemba Walker is easily the best player on the floor, and he is the big reason why Charlotte took this one tonight.
Something else I wanted to talk about from this game: the last good backup point guard that Charlotte had, Jeremy Lin, had a nice game in his former building. 19 points, which led Atlanta on 7-9 shooting, almost all of which from 2-point range. He was six of eight from two, and then 1 of 1 from three. Also got to the free throw line for 4 shots and played under control, looked more dynamic than we had seen earlier in this season. He's battled injuries for the last 2 years, and due to Atlanta's structure, they're not really going to play Lin more unless they do some with Trae Young, which I would actually support. I think it'd be kind of fun to see those guys bounce off each other. But I'm really happy for Jeremy Lin that he can do well in this role. And I don't know exactly what he wants from this season. Maybe if he wants to get bought out and have a playoff run on a more competitive team, maybe Atlanta will be amenable to that. But yeah, I enjoy capable backup point guard play. I enjoy point guard play. I talked about this actually on Twitter during the day today, that it's the easiest, it's the most important factor in terms of watchability for a team. And if you notice the ones that we enjoy talking about and the ones we don't, it's a very easy way to do it. You know, there are other important factors too. And backup point guard play is pivotal to that as well. And Lin has really helped Atlanta. So with him and Trae Young, I generally enjoy really watching their games.
Yeah, great to see Lin playing well, because you remember he was so bad early in the season that they actually were going to lineups that had no point guard at all. They're playing Bembry at point guard. And
giving Huerter more playmaking, which I actually like. I've enjoyed Huerter with the ball in his hands.
Yeah, but Lin, I mean, Charlotte, some of that team has turned over, obviously, since he was there, but they were letting him get to his left hand pretty well. He hit a three, had a nice pull up in the lane. He was operating in pick and roll. And, you know, he's always been a very right-handed player, but he is, once he gets there, and, you know, it's tough to keep a guy off of the hand he wants to go to, at least out on the floor and at least in pick and roll situations. So it was good to see him back. I mean, but torn patellar tendon, it doesn't get as much pub as Achilles, but there's not a long list of guys who've come back 100% from torn patellar tendons that I can recall. So hopefully Lin can continue to play at a reasonably good rate. We mentioned Young. I mean, a lot of what he's doing looks like it's stuff that you just can't really question. Like, the vision continues to be awesome. I mean, there's one play that really stood out to me where he ran a pick and roll going to his left. He's been more effective going to his left lately. Teams have been forcing him off of that right hand where he's more comfortable shooting it. And so the big stepped out. He's at about the elbow, and it didn't look like Dewayne Dedmon was open, but he was being guarded by Kemba Walker. But Walker was like right next to him. You know, usually you'll see a guy next to him, you're not going to throw an alley-oop. But Young was like, oh, that's Kemba Walker against Dewayne Dedmon. I can throw this even though he's not technically open, just because if these guys both run to the rim, Dedmon's going to be able to get way up, way higher and put this down. I mean, it was just, he threw Dedmon open. I mean, he wasn't even really, I think, ahead of Walker going towards the rim when the pass was made. It was really just a beautiful play. I mean, he'll get these plays in semi-transition to these no looks where he finds guys open under the rim. And it's just, it's not passes that you see all the time in the NBA. I mean, these dimes are like, you know, to guys like right under the rim or for alley-oops. I mean, these are really value-added stuff. He had 10 assists tonight. He had a really rough start to the game. At one point, he was 1 out of 5 with 5 turnovers, and he did not hit a three. He was 0 of 7 for 3, was not getting the greatest of looks there either. I mean, I think him taking those are still important because it set up so much of his drive game. And I think he's just been quicker than advertised, too. So I'm convinced already that he's going to be a solid offensive point guard at a minimum. The question to me of whether he's going to be a star is how much is that jump shot going to really go down? You know, I mean, there's times when it looks awesome. There's other times when, you know, especially when he's contested, especially when he's taking a contested 30-footer, that you really kind of wonder. And so, I mean, is he going to take a crap load of shots? We know he's going to do that. Is that going to go in at 33% of the time, or is he going to make 37, 38? We talked about that in the 15 and 60. Like, if it's the latter, he's going to be really a dominating offensive player, I think, because he's looked much better as a finisher, much quicker, and the vision has, in fact, translated so far.
Agreed on all counts. There are three highlights from this game that I wanted to mention briefly because I thought they were notable. So the first one is probably the least discussed, least clipped RIP Vine of these, and that's Alex Poitras. So there was a play when Charlotte had an inbound with very little time left on the shot clock, and Poitras basically timed up the catch and release, I think it was from Jeremy Lamb, and was able to block what was a desperate flip in, and it was a beautiful play, led to a fast break. I love it when guys understand the situation and understand that, okay, this guy's gonna have to get the shot off quickly, so that's what I should be looking for. Then the other two were more conventional highlights. Vince Carter, slightly older than Vince Young, getting his shoulder past Jeremy Lamb and then dunking, which was very nice. And then Miles Bridges just dunking all over Dwayne Dedmon and doing Vince's motorcycle celebration, which was pretty fun. And that also led to some real tangible effects, because there was a later play when Bridges was driving and Dedmon just went for a charge instead of actually playing defense. And that's something that happens. You get a little bit gun shy when a guy dunks all over you.
Yeah, I need to enter those two dunks into our dunk of the month category here. Few other notes from this one. Charlotte started out with what I thought was a pretty good plan. They got Marvin Williams going in pick and pop against the aforementioned Spellman, who looks pretty heavy legged, starting him at the four. I mean, they had been starting Carter a little bit. I think there's just some reasons to start him, just to say you're starting a first round draft pick. You know, that was kind of publicized by the broadcast crew on the intro. The three first rounders starting together for the first time and going a combined 0 for 12 from 3-point range in this game. But Spellman can't defend at the four. Although Atlanta's defense still continues to be like decent enough. I mean, they only gave up a 105 defensive rating this game. They just continue to be like the worst offense in the league, in part again due to the turnovers. They turned it over on 20% of their possessions in this game. Herder, I thought his rebounding continues to be impressive. His playmaking is good. He's got some passing vision. Finishing around the rim looked good. He had one play where he swooped in from the right side, left hand, left foot, finished for a scoop layup around Nick Batum that looked really good. But defensively, he's another guy who just short arms, not really going to affect shooters very well. And so I thought he and Trey together, if that's going to be their starting backcourt, could be a problem in the long term on defense. For Charlotte, I thought Cody Zeller just offensively seemed to struggle to finish the rim. He played 27 minutes, but he was not generating. A lot of times you'll see an indication of declining athleticism as for a pick and roll big is that his usage rate will go way down, and he just isn't taking as many shots as he had been. He uncorked some three-pointers earlier in the year. You know, that didn't really seem to be a featured aspect of his game. And, you know, his first three shots of the game were all around the rim, and he just didn't have the explosion to finish. You got anything else on this one?
No, I think that's about it.
I guess it's worth noting too that the Hawks were 6 of 30 from 3-point range, 20%, and the Hornets were 13 of 31, 42%, and that was basically the difference in a 113-102 victory.
Yeah, I think that's a good note to bring in there. Do you want me to do a very brief summary of Washington-Dallas, because I know it was not high on your radar, it was the other three games you were focusing
on.
Washington's defense sucks. End of statement.
I thought the quotes...
That's really all I need to say.
I thought the quotes afterwards were interesting. I mean, they gave up 70 points in the first half. They trailed 70-49 at halftime. the quotes afterwards were they kind of got back into it. They got within six, and then Dallas ended up winning by like 15. But they're like, oh yeah, you know, we just didn't try in the first half. Austin Rivers said that. Howard said that. We're like, yeah, we just came out and tried. We're doing the same scheme in the second half. We didn't change up at all. We just executed more. So yeah, Fred Katz is gonna have a fun year.
Fred Katz was going to have a fun year either way.
That's true. Fred always.
Yeah, I think they'll be a lot. We talked about them a lot in the 15 and 60. I mean, that's the benefit of being a Liam team. But and we might talk about them later in the week, not to spoil a segment that's coming up. But I think they will be better. It's just hard. I mean, when you're 2-8, even if the bottom of the East is bad, like, you know, the bottom of the East playoff picture is not, you know, 50 wins or something like that. You still have to actually win the games, and they're starting. This is the beginning of a road trip for them, so we'll see where this goes. I have an idea of where it's going, but I'm not sure yet.
Yeah, their schedule is easier though, even if there is more road games.
Yes, weaker yeah, opponents.
But Dallas is supposed to be one of those, obviously, and they just got blown out. But yeah, I mean, they better right the ship here. Now, of course, they started famously 2-8 2 years ago and ended up winning 49 games. So I don't know if they're going to turn that around though. And Zach Lowe wrote a long piece about them in which, you know, he kind of diagnosed the biggest problem as John Wall kind of plateauing a little bit. And you know, he's going to be 28 when that huge contract kicks in, and I fear that his best days may already have been behind him. So before we move on, though, I want to tell you about Bombas. Socks are incredibly important to me, especially now that I work from home. I spend basically all of my time in socks because my wife insists that we take our shoes off indoors. And so I can't have my feet getting too cold. I can't have them getting too hot. I don't want to feel my socks. I don't want that sorry sock line. And then if I want to go work out, go play some basketball, maybe put on some no-show socks as well. Bombas has great stuff for that too. I really appreciate that they provide the extra support where you need it. They've got this reinforced cushion footbed that doesn't add bulkiness. Their no-show socks have this little pad in the back to keep the back of your shoe from rubbing against your Achilles. And when I take them off, my feet aren't all sweaty. They breathe, but I'm also not getting my toes cold. Since I'm 6'6", my toes are pretty far away from my heart. They tend to get cold pretty easily, and Bombas takes care of that. It's Bombas is how you spell Bombas. Bombas.com/capspace. is the URL, and then you can use the code CAPSPACE for 20% off your first order. We talk about CAPSPACE all the time on the program, of course. That's bombas.com/CAPSPACE. Then enter that CAPSPACE code for 20% off your first order, and enter that code to let them know that you came from us. Let's turn to Brooklyn and Phoenix. It was a little bit closer than the final 104-82 score, but not much closer. The Nets held a 10-point lead basically from the second quarter on. Phoenix got within five, I think, a couple of times. Big story here, Caris LeVert continues to play well. He had 26 points on only 18 shooting possessions. He really continues to just show excellent poise and patience as a driver. He doesn't get sped up. He's another one of these guys who really benefits from there being more spacing. You know, the Nets, not always, as we'll get to, but most of the time have very good spacing on their team. And so he can get in the lane, he can pump fake, he can step through. You also have a lot more time when DeAndre Ayton is the opposing center, and he's just not going to come and help, even if his man is Ed Davis, and Ed Davis is standing 25 feet from the basket. He's still not going to come and help. I really just like the patience of LeVert. And between he and Dinwiddie, these guys are starting to get, as Dinwiddie had another nice game, he was plus 20 in 30 minutes, 12 points on seven shooting possessions. They're starting to get guys who can actually attack the rim and make something happen and make up for the spacing. I mean, and I thought the Nets actually got really good shots in this game, but they just were only 9 out of 36 from three, and those were largely pretty good three-point shooters. I mean, Dudley was 1 of 5, Harris was 1 of 6, Crabb was 1 of 5. I mean, these are good three-point shooters, guys who've shot around 40% in their career, so they were generating very good shots. This could have been even worse of a blowout than it was for Phoenix. I mean, and for Phoenix to put up an 85 offensive rating against this Nets team, and they didn't even shoot poorly from three. They were 36% from downtown, and that is really, really ugly.
One point in the game I wanted to bring up, I felt like Brooklyn was going to win anyway when the fourth quarter started. I mean, they had a lead. But Dinwiddie put up 7 points in pretty quick succession. And that really, even though Phoenix was scoring a little bit at the time too, it kind of helped settle the margin. And Dinwiddie is overqualified for me for that role of being like the bench scorer or anything like that. But he's still really good at it, even if he could be doing other things. And you brought up the Dinwiddie-LeVert combination really helping them. And they were able in this game, partially because the Suns' offense, I mean, 20 turnovers were a big challenge there, 9 of which were live ball with steals, that the Nets were able to overcome some just rough missed shots to still put a good win out there and an overall, you know, a decent offensive game. I mean, for missing almost 30 threes to still put up like a 107 offensive rating is pretty good. Not bad.
There were a few nice things in this for Phoenix. We'll try to be a little more positive. Just some small touches where, you know, I think Kokoshkov has had an effect. They actually lead the NBA in passes per game, which has not helped them a ton so far. I thought Rashawn Holmes played really well. He's now in the rotation.
Yeah.
Dude.
He brought a lot of energy.
Yeah, I mean, he was negative 14, which wasn't great. But he had 13 points, 6 of 7 from the field, 4 offensive rebounds, 2 blocks. You know, he was a force protecting the rim, I thought. And finished pretty well. He did take one free throw line jumper, which was not even close. There's a thought that he would become more of a stretch threat early in his career in Philly. That really is not developed at all. His jumper looks pretty ugly. When they were here last week, or I think it was 2 weeks ago, you know, he just didn't look great shooting around before the game either. Shoots it way out in front of his face. It's not a very versatile jump shot either. And I thought that the Nets strategy defensively was interesting, where Kokoshkov is having these guys do a lot of handoffs around the free throw line 20 feet from the rim, and so they just had Jared Allen and Ed Davis just hang completely back and just take away any of the cutting off of those DHOs by just having the guy stand under the rim and say, hey, you want to hand it to this guy, go ahead, he's going to go right into our center at the rim. And so Holmes was left wide open for a free throw line jumper. Ayton, who's usually pretty capable from there, was not hitting the jumper in this game, either in face-up situations or out of those DHOs. So I thought that was just an interesting strategic wrinkle of how the Nets were approaching dealing with some of Kokoshkov's stuff. The Suns do get a reasonable number of situations where, like a lot of teams, where they're just caught with their big defending out on the floor and pick and roll. But anytime that big made the guard shoot a jumper for the Nets, he then immediately sprinted the floor and started posting up, and the Suns really tried to push it and get it to that guy, and they drew some fouls there. They got some buckets, which is, that's a smart way to say, hey, all right, you want to switch, you think you got a mismatch against us, all right, well, you better make that shot, because if you don't, now we're going to run the floor hard and we're going to get a mismatch against you. I like that approach, but I think that's about all good that I can come up with for the Suns in this one, I'm afraid.
An example of that one was, I loved a transition seal that Ayton got on D'Angelo Russell. Russell just had no chance and fouled Ayton pretty quickly. And I can't remember whether they were in the bonus or not, whether that yielded free throws. But it's also a great way to activate big men to actually get out there on the perimeter and be there. Say, hey, if you actually contest this, then you can go out there and we'll try to find you. And they're going to need better guys to do the finding. And they'll get there, hopefully, eventually with time. And then the other thing we should talk about in this game is the ongoing dynamic between Mikal Bridges and Josh Jackson. Josh Jackson was barely a part of the rotation the first three quarters, did start the fourth quarter, ended up with 7 minutes played. And Mikal Bridges is a more reliable player. I believe he is a better player, and he played 28.
Yeah, Bridges hit 2 of 5 from downtown. I mean, he wasn't awesome by any means. You know, he had a couple plays where he got blown by in that sequence you talked about. But, you know, I tweeted it during the first game of summer league that it was going to be awkward when Bridges started taking Jackson's minutes. Even I didn't think it would happen this quickly. And you know, things can change. I thought actually when Jackson was out there in the second half, he did some okay things, but then he got a little big for his britches and went into traffic on a no-hoper and got blocked. But I thought he had a couple of chances where he could have pulled up for one of his signature contested twos and instead actually made nice passes off it, stayed under control. But then in his stint in the first half, it was really weird. He and Bridges were out there together, and they're guarding Crabbe and Harris. Those two guys would screen for each other, and you'd think, oh, Crabbe and Harris, similar size guys. Bridges and Jackson, similar size guys. Off-ball switch, easy. You know, obviously you're going to switch that. And yet, 3 possessions in a row, the Nets got open shots out of that action because they didn't switch. And I was like, are they supposed to switch that? I mean, you would think they would have to be, right? Like, you know. So, and then Jackson got taken out after that. I'm not sure if that was the reason or whether Kokoshkov just wasn't really planning on playing him that much. So we'll watch that dynamic. TJ Warren also really has come back to earth. He did not attempt a three-pointer in this one. He was 0-for-5. He played pretty poorly. You know, I think the reality has set in that this is going to be developmental. I mean, and this is the sort of loss that's got to be really disheartening for the Suns. I mean, their team is healthy. Booker is back. The Nets are, you know, team supposed to be at the bottom in the Eastern Conference. And the Suns just weren't competitive and they couldn't score against, you know, not a good Net defense. Maybe we'll see where they're at the end of the year, but you know, not a team that's historically been a great defense. That's a disheartening home loss, to be sure.
One other thing that amused me in this game was Rondae Hollis-Jefferson took some ill-advised shots. I'll phrase it that way. But having Ed Davis as the other big man on the floor, he could just grab a bunch of those misses. And so I think a few of his offensive rebounds were off of Rondae misses. And I just enjoy Ed Davis's commitment to grabbing offensive rebounds and battling. And you don't have to defend him outside of 5 feet. You just have to box him out and everything else. But I like having his competence on this second unit for the Nets. And, you know, Jared Allen, this was a fine game for him, not necessarily a standout for me, though he did have a couple of assists. And, you know, I think that those to me weren't necessarily like, oh my God, he has great vision for a center or anything like that. But I like that I can kind of trust Brooklyn's center rotation because that has definitely not always been the case.
Yeah, they started Timofey Mozgov last year, although that quickly was scrapped. You know, Damari Carroll is supposed to be back later this week. And I think that's going to be really interesting for this Nets rotation. You know, Jared Dudley is starting for them. He, I think, gives them some spacing. In theory, Rondae is a younger player. You'd think that Rondae would have had the inside track to play ahead of him. Rondae was coming back from that groin issue, though. And I think they've played reasonably well with Dudley out there. They've also been playing some of Joe Harris at the four. Dudley and Harris start together, but then they'll go to lineups with Crabbe at the three. They even played all three of the point guards. Or I guess LeVert isn't really a point guard, but Russell, LeVert, Dinwiddie, all three of the ball handlers. And those guys are all 6'4 or over, so you're not that small there, although, you know, it's not like Phoenix has a small forward who's going to kill you the way some other teams might with a little more size. But I honestly think they should probably, if they're trying to win games, just take Rondae out of the rotation and play Carroll at the four, because whenever Rondae is in there, it really negatively affects their spacing. Like, all the actions that work really well, all of a sudden either his man is not being guarded, he's standing under the rim, but he's not like that type of elite finisher to go up and get an alley-oop or finish through guys. I had hoped he would be that player when he was drafted, but he either lost athleticism or I just thought he was more athletic than he was at Arizona. I'm not sure. And, you know, he's not doing enough defensively, especially if you're going up against a Phoenix where you don't have like one guy that you need to guard with him. You know, I'm not sure that he's that much better defensively even than, you know, someone like Carroll, if Carroll is healthy. So I think they might actually take him out of the rotation. That's what I would do, unless he starts playing better, because he really short circuits the offense. And he was the only Net who was in the negative today. He played 13 minutes, and I thought he earned that, you know, both with that 1-6 that you talked about, but also with the lack of spacing that he provides, especially because, you know, they don't have Brook Lopez anymore, you know, as they did earlier in his career. They don't really have a stretch center anymore. You know, Allen will pop out to the corner every once in a while, but he's usually going to be the roll man. And so you're just not going to be able to pick and roll when you have Hollis Jefferson on the floor with another traditional big.
The story with Rondae for me is very similar to a guy we didn't talk about in his game today, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, where if you are a non-center who teams do not have to respect as a jump shooter, you have to do so many other things well to justify regular minutes. And that can be defense, rebounding, finishing at the rim. There are lots of different ways to do it. But if not, even with the dearth of quality forwards in the league right now, you can go to maybe players who are inferior options, but take less off the table and be better for it. And I think that's part of where the league might be going. I don't think we have enough supply to get there yet. But yeah, I was watching Rondae and thinking something pretty similar once they actually have the guys to replace him.
Yeah, and then if he's going to compound it by like trying to go one-on-one, that makes it even worse because he's not that great at that. A few other notes here. The Suns don't really have anyone who can get by anybody, I realized. You know, I mean, they're running these Isaiah Cannon pick and rolls, which just, you know, he's in the starting lineup still at the one. I thought Devin Booker looked really slow in this game. I mean, this is not a Nets team that has elite perimeter defenders, and he just largely was struggling to get good shots. You know, he could get a shot off of a screen if the Nets were hanging back in pick and roll, but when he tried to ISO, and usually I feel he's able to create more space every once in a while, he can get by his guy, and just wasn't succeeding at that. He went 6 out of 21, and I thought he earned that with the quality of shots that he had. Ayton, I mean, I continue to actually be positively surprised by his post game. Now, if you give it to him outside of the lane and expect him to score, that's not necessarily going to work, even if it's against a mismatch, because it takes him too long to dribble in. He's kind of doesn't have the greatest feel for that. But the fact that he's been posting up pretty deep, I think, has been nice to see. And that Kokoschkov has encouraged that. It was more really in the second half than the first half. But when he gets the ball around the rim, he's finishing very nicely. His left hand is better than anticipated. He had a nice same side up and under with the left hand. You know, you don't have to have like a left-handed jump hook from 10 feet from the basket, but as long as you can just finish layups around the rim and very short range hook shots around the rim, that's all you need with the left hand. So his touch there has been impressive. Didn't have the jumper working today, as I said, but the defense remains very bad. I mean, there are probably 7 or 8 times that I counted, and I wasn't looking for this on every single possession. It was just, hey, they got a layup. How did that happen? Oh, Ayton didn't come over. And there are probably 7 or 8 of those in this game, and plays where, you know, he just had no reason not to be helping, right? It's not like he was guarding a shooter at any point in time. Just drives would occur and he just wouldn't react. And the other thing that's been a struggle for him is making multiple efforts on a play. This was most obvious on a play where Alan Crabb got 2 consecutive offensive rebounds, and Ayton kind of went after the first rebound and then sort of tried to block the shot, and then the ball went over to the other side of the rim and Ayton just never reacted again. You know, he's kind of like, he's able to summon one effort and then it's just like, all right, I did my job, I did all I could, and he just kind of floats out of the play after that. So that's something that I think he really could improve right away, the recognition stuff less so. But you know, it's so hard as a coach to come up with a program to help him get better. I mean, I think where you probably would want to start with him is almost get him to overhelp at this point, to say, hey, you know what, if you leave your man and give up a dunk to go block someone's shot at the rim, like, that's okay. You know, we'll bring someone else to help you there. Like, we want your instinct to be, I'm going to challenge these guys, and then we'll get you to tone that down. You know, Tibbs actually kind of tried that with Carl Towns last year. It didn't really work. But, you know, I'm not really sure what a better approach is. And then other times he's going to be too aggressive and not really take the angles in pick and roll defense. You know, we'll see a lot of times where the guard will kind of turn the corner, but not really be much of a threat yet, be kind of at the, like, you know, the elbow extended a little bit. And Ayton will step up, but he's stepping up completely into the guard's path, opening up a passing window. Really, when you come over there, you want to be in the guard's vision, but it's more like, hey, I want you to see me so you know that if you do try to go all the way to the rim, I can get there to stop you. Not, I'm putting my body fully in front of you when you're that far away from the rim, because then you just have the passing angle to throw it right to the big for a dunk. And that happened a couple of times. You got to kind of stay on the axis between the ball and your initial man, the roll man.
I like to bet on guys with a lot of physical talent to do this. The guy, when you were talking about being overly aggressive and helping, I was thinking about Miles Turner as being maybe somebody that you go in that direction. Turner's getting a lot better. He's also relying on his size more now than he used to. So that's good. And Ayton, hopefully he gets to that point. Hopefully he goes beyond that point, but it is going to take some time. And so I was watching the Suns in this one and also thinking about where they'll be when they can kind of have better talent around these guys. It looks to me like they're going to have another strong draft pick this year, and maybe for another year after that. We'll see how long it takes for them to figure this out.
Yeah, they'll have a high draft pick. Maybe would be a more,
yes,
more accurate way of saying,
yes,
it.
Sure. And with the Nets, this is the type of game, I mean, I'm not ready to say they're like they have a potential for making the playoffs, but taking care of business against a team that you're better than on the road is a good start. And so for me, they're probably in the mix of needing to play a little bit over their heads and also get some, you know, have better health than some of the teams above them. But that's where this road begins. And it's going to take, you know, it's not just being competitive and then losing like they've done a fair portion of this year. It's also getting the baseline wins and then building from there.
Yeah, right now 538 projects the Nets for 35 wins and a 32% chance of the playoffs. That's not bad. You know, I mean, I think that's better than we thought that they would be. And I think, you know, the biggest thing probably that has been a surprise for them in the early going has been LeVert breaking out the way that he has. Well, tomorrow we'll be back with the NBA cast. Hashtag NBA cast. Follow me on Twitch, twitch.tv/NateDuncanNBA. We'll talk a little bit more about those Pacers. Pacers versus Sixers. This could be an interesting one for seeding. I really enjoy the Pacers and the Sixers because both these teams play a little bit different style than a lot of the teams do in the league at this point. And, you know, Oladipo, Simmons, Embiid, like those are all pretty interesting players in my mind, particularly Embiid going up against Sabonis and Turner is going to be a pretty interesting one in the post there. Anything you need to talk about before we go?
I'm not sure if it's going to come out on Wednesday, but I have a piece coming out for The Athletic on a matter that has not yet, to my knowledge, been discussed that I find a really interesting issue. That's all the tease I can give it because I don't want to get it out there yet, but I'm really excited about it. The Athletic is actually putting some reporting behind it, which is pretty fun. So like I submitted it and now they're actually following up with somebody who, you know, using the amazing network of Athletic writers, theathletic.com.
I've been enjoying how like all the Athletics are like, you know, Shams and like the local guy are doing like doing stuff together now. Like that's they're kind of bringing all those guns to bear on a story. It has really helped the reporting, I think.
Well, yeah, and I mean the work that Shams and John Krasinski have done on the Jimmy Butler thing is just incredible. And that's just one example of it. But yeah, I've been really happy with that. And so getting a little bit involved in that myself has been really fun, and that's going to continue until the piece comes out. And yeah, that's about it for right now. And also we should mention that not only are we're doing the NBA cast tomorrow, but we'll be doing, I don't know, a version of A Gamer Dunked On as well. So we'll catch up on news, and then we'll also talk about what we watch tomorrow night.
All right, talk to you all then.